Thank you for the introduction, Karen. So, welcome. So this is, actually, John's talk was great. This is going to kind of piggyback on what John introduced. So it's going to save me a couple minutes, maybe, we'll see. So yes, I work here at the University of Strathclyde, and I work in the Center of Ultrasonic Engineering. And the group as a whole does a lot of different things, largely around ultrasonic sound, particularly with non-destructive testing. So they're very interested in using techniques not to destroy things, but to test how they work using ultrasound. I work in a completely different group of that same organization. I work in a bioacoustics group, where we're far more interested in developing novel acoustic sensors. So hopefully the talk, hopefully in this talk, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you from bioinspiration to providing you a couple of examples of how we go from that to the construction or the development of novel acoustic sensors. And then we'll come back around with a short summary. So you can follow along on the bottom so you know where I am on the talk. So biological systems provide a plethora of diverse solutions to life's challenges, which John introduced quite eloquently. And those solutions are developed through the process of natural selection. So these solutions evolve over time. As for us, we generally create problems more than we solve. And the problems that we do create, we generally look towards engineers to solve these anthropogenic problems. And when these two things overlap, this is where we wind up getting bioinspiration. And this terminology is relatively new, but the concept is exceptionally old. As humans, throughout our history, we've incorporated bio-inspired things in our lives throughout our history. But more importantly to the topic at hand, in Q, we tend to look to the environment for inspiration and for acoustic systems. And more often than not, we turn to insects for that inspiration. So we heard a lot in the previous talk about mostly fuzzy, cute animals. But insects can also be quite cute, but they're often left out. So there are 32 orders of insects. They belong to the most successful group on the planet, which is the arthropods. And insects communicate in a whole host of different ways. But for the purpose of this group, we're talking about acoustic communication. And interestingly enough, only 7 out of these 32 orders actually use acoustic communication in a typical sense. And what I mean by that is these 7 orders have tympanic membranes and can hear in a typical sense. So it's not very common. So as a biologist, what I find interesting about insect hearing systems is partly their evolution. So the 7 insect orders that have evolved hearing, it is hypothesized that they have evolved this hearing independently. So that these 7 orders do not have a common ancestor that was a hearing insect. And what's also interesting is there are only 2 hypothesized reasons why insects have evolved hearing, and John introduced one of those, and that is to avoid these nasty insectivorous bats that hunt using sonar or ultrasonic communication. So any moth that could pick up that sound would have a higher ability or a greater probability of surviving and producing offspring. The other reason why insects have developed hearing or acoustic communication is in the purpose of mating. And John talked a bit about this, but with furry, pretty looking animals. But insects do this as well. And then from a biological perspective, but also from physics and an engineering perspective, there are serious innate challenges with being small and determining the direction of a sound source and perceiving frequencies. And so here's an example of a disembodied person with a very big head sitting between 2 ears or acoustic sensors. And this big head creates a distance between these 2 ears, and our ears, like other mammals, are independent, and they're joined together in the nervous system. So if you have this large distance between sensors, your acoustic sensors can pick up differences in amplitude differences between the 2 ears. These are called IIDs. And they can also pick up the time difference in arrival at the 2 ears. These are called ITDs. But when we consider an insect, which they're generally small in size, let's consider one maybe the size of a housefly. Briefly heard it. These ears would not be, they'd be too close together to pick up any IIDs or ITDs. They would not function as independent devices. And so in insects, what you wind up seeing is that the ears are no longer independent. They're usually mechanically coupled in some way. So most insect systems, the ears either share a common air system or chamber, or they're actually mechanically coupled. And what this creates is when one side is stimulated, the other side is dampened. And that's very, very important because that system allows the nervous system to catch up. So it allows a delay to happen so that the nervous system can detect which direction the sound source came from. So that's the brief introduction. Now I want to switch and talk about a system, a system that could lead to the development of novel acoustic sensors. And generally in these cases, we always start with the biology because that's what creates the inspiration to make these acoustic sensors. And in this moth, this is the lesser wax moth, males will attract females by wing fanning. And this wing fanning produces a very high frequency call, so 100 kilohertz, which is way outside of the range of human hearing. And the signal is actually produced by this tympanic, this tymbal organ right here. And females will use this male call to find a male in order to mate. And they do this on foot. So the females are not flying to the male, they're finding the male on foot. So this is an example, five examples, of a path females took to locate an attractive male call. And this is XY coordinate space. And what I hope you can see from this figure is none of these paths are straight. So they are not very efficient. They're all curved paths. And if we zoom in closer on one example, we see that females are really doing something quite interesting. They're actually going rocking back and forth. So they're going from the left side or right side of their body to the complete opposite side. So they're basically almost preferentially stimulating one of two ears, always going back and forth. This is an interesting behavior. And it might have something to do with the ears. Hint, hint. So to measure how the ears are displaced by sound energy, we use a technology called laser vibrometry. And this is a diagram of a typical setup we would use. So here the specimen is not a moth, it's a locust, but we shine the laser beam onto its tympanic membrane. We use a loudspeaker to excite the membrane with sound, and we use a reference microphone just to make sure everything's okay. If you're not familiar with how laser vibrometry works, it's essentially a very expensive laser pin, and it works off the Doppler principle. So as the light hits something, let's say a sheet of paper, and it's reflected back to the laser, if there's any vibration in the paper, that wave will be changed in phase and in amplitude, and then we can interpret that and do other mathematical functions on that information. So using this technique, we scanned the tympanic membranes of this moth in a whole lot of places. Each one of these points is a measuring point. And by doing that, we can see in an animation how the tympanic membrane actually moves when it's stimulated with sound. And in this case, the tympanic membrane is being stimulated by a sound that's at 0 degrees in relation to the moth's body. And we repeated this measurement every 30 degrees on both sides of the animal. And when we bring all of that data together, we find something quite interesting about this preferential stimulation of the ear. What we see is the angle of the incident sound is on the x-axis, so this is that angle at which the sound was played, and the displacement of the membrane is in the y. It's quite easy to see, I think, that this 30 degree, in this case negative 30 degrees, is the optimal angle that creates the biggest displacement in the insect ear. And this is mirrored for the left, except for it would be positive 30 degrees instead of negative 30 degrees. Now, interestingly enough, if we look at where the ears are on the moth's body, we see that the ears are also offset, and they're offset by almost 30 degrees. This is really interesting. So when we consider the path that we just saw, the females are basically stimulating one ear and then switching to the other ear at this 30 degree angle. But how does the sound actually deflect around the insect's body to create this path or pattern that we would see? This is very difficult to do. So what we do is we simulate this in modeling. So we use a computer And we basically create a very simplified geometry of the insect's body and then put a sound field around that animal. And what we see, or what I hope you see, is that the sound source is basically concentrated at the location of the tympanic membranes, which you can see by the arrow. And if the sound source is at 0 degrees, both of the tympanic membranes are being somewhat equally stimulated. But if we move that source and go off angle at, say, negative 30 degrees, we see almost a preferential stimulation of one tympanic membrane. Now, I will remind you that this is just a prediction because it's a model, so it may not be what's actually happening in reality, but it's, we think, a good approximation. So we want to make sure that these ears are independent. In order to do that, we need to see what's going on inside. And to do that, we use X-ray micro-CT to visualize the internal structures. And these are the pockets of the two ears. And by viewing a whole host of different moth bodies, what we've come to see is that these ears are not mechanically coupled in any way. So there's no sclerotized connection, as we see in all other insect ears, and there's no shared airspace. So this is the first time we've ever seen two ears that act independent of each other in an insect. So using multidisciplinary approaches, starting with animal behavior, bringing that animal into the lab, and using a mix of biology and engineering technologies, we have discovered a completely novel hearing system in a moth. This technology could very well lead to bio-inspired microphones that work in this similar framework as the moth ears. So I'm going to switch gears now and talk about a system that has led to the creation of bio-inspired microphones, and that's using the fly Ormia acratia. Most of the behavior work occurred in the early 90s, which has led to the creation of these devices more recently. So Ormia acratia is a fly, and it's an acoustic parasitic fly, so it has an interesting behavior. When females are ready to lay eggs, they need to find a host, and that host, unfortunately, well, I guess fortunately, it's not us, it happens to be field crickets. And the way females localize field crickets is by male calls. So male field crickets produce a courtship call at about 5 kilohertz, and when a female fly hears that call, and she's ready to lay eggs, she will localize that call, and incredibly accurate, up to 2 degrees of, within 2 degrees, which is quite incredible when you consider that the fly's hearing system is only about 1.5 millimeters in length, and the wavelength of a 5 kilohertz song or call is 7 centimeters. So how does this work? Well, I've kind of given you a hint of how it worked in my introduction, but I'll walk you through it, how it works here in Ormia acratia. So the hearing system is located just underneath the head on the first thoracic segment of the insect. And the only reason you can see that is the head has been removed from the insect. And there are two tympanic membranes, and together they only span about 1.5 millimeters, so very, very small. But they work because they are coupled together. So they share a common airspace, which is highlighted there in blue, and they have a sclerotized rod that is connecting both of them. So when one is activated, the other one is depressed. And so that's how this works. And what this leads to is a very small, very sensitive directional sensor that has inspired the creation of novel acoustic sensors. So now I'm going to switch gears and talk about those. So you may have come across this word MEMS microphone before, and MEMS, all that stands for is microelectric mechanical system. And there have been several that have been designed completely on this premise of Ormia acratia. Now, rather than talk about each one of these independently, I'm going to basically lump them together, and I'm going to talk a little bit about their drawbacks and some things that we could potentially improve upon. So the first one is most of these devices, I'm going to be using the red light, yellow light, green light, go idea to lump them together. So one of the problems with our drawbacks to a lot of these devices is that they work at very narrow frequency bands, much like the fly. So the fly had two membranes, but they were really only sensitive to 5 kilohertz. That was their peak working frequency. And we see the similar thing with most of these devices. They have two membranes, they're coupled, they generally have one frequency that they're active at. One way to solve this problem is to add more diaphragms and that could or should increase the number of resonant frequencies possible in the system. One other common drawback to these systems is they're very complex. They use very complex fabrication processes and sometimes use materials that aren't easy to get or use optical sensing, which is in the case of the first one. So one easy way to bypass this is essentially simplify the design, have in mind how you're going to fabricate the device so it's easy to replicate. So that's some possible solutions to those problems. And then lastly, not necessarily a problem, but it could be a problem if you're trying to get your device into a very, very small thing, and that is the need for a reference microphone, because that adds space on your device. And so the reason why we have a reference microphone is most of the time in these devices, the way that we know the direction of an incoming sound is by an amplitude difference. And so you can compare the membrane or the diaphragm amplitude to a reference microphone, and that's how you can tell the difference. Is there a fly? I didn't bring it. Did not do that. So a possible solution is instead of using a microphone, you can use electronics to differentiate the difference between the two arrival time differences in the diaphragms. All right, so our group has designed several Ormia-inspired microphones, and this is one of the concept designs that we've done, and so I'm sharing that with all of you today. So addressing the first red light, increasing the number of resonant frequencies. And in this concept design, we do that by using two diaphragm plates, rectangular plates, that can move independently, though they share the same base structure or rod, which is right here. This should give us 4 degrees of freedom in motion, resulting in these predicted 4 mode shapes. So 2 rocking and 2 bending. So we should have 4 working frequencies here. And in the fabrication process, we have grossly simplified that because it's essentially two rectangles and they share a common beam. The microphone is using single crystal silicone, which I'm a biologist, I don't know much about that. But it is using for transduction, it's using piezoelectric transduction, which all that means is it's taking the sound energy, which is physical or mechanical, and it's turning that into electrical current. And the whole device is 5.5 millimeters in square. And this is designed to work in small electronic devices like cell phones and things similar. So before we actually design and make the device, or fabricate the device, we put our device in a computer simulation, just like we did with the moth body, and we see how it responds to a sound field. And in this case, what we see is, fortunately, we see our 4 mode shapes that we predicted that we would see. We see 2 rocking and 2 bending, which gives us a much broader frequency range of usage. So we have 4 resonant frequencies here. And we've concentrated purposely on keeping these resonant frequencies below 15 kilohertz, because that is where most of human hearing happens, is under 15 kilohertz. Unless you're really young, you get to go all the way up to 20. I can't hear that high anymore. So after we prove that the concept could work, we fabricate the concept. And this is a real fabrication. We use, again, laser vibrometry to see how it works in a sound field, much like we did with the moth. And we see the exact same thing that we saw with the model, which is really good. We see the 2 rocking modes, we see the 2 bending modes, and very comparable frequency performance. There is difference, but there's always a difference between a computer simulation and reality. But we do see the same trend that we were looking for. The amplitudes are greatly reduced if you were paying attention. It's okay if you weren't. I was kind of hiding it, but I'm not hiding it. The amplitudes are much lower, and that's largely because this is a real model. It has piezoelectric material, which tends to be heavier in reality than in the simulation, so the amplitudes are lower, but still within reason and functional. So to summarize this part here, what we have is we have a concept that proved functional both in simulation and in reality. We have a device that works at broader frequency ranges, which is what we are really shooting for. We have simplified the fabrication process, and you'll just have to take my word for it, but we have simplified that process, so it is much easier to make, drives the cost down, so for mass production, they could be easily produced. However, we did decide in this concept to keep the microphone, which is actually this square here, in order to keep a very high precision and detection of phase differentiation. We have some newer concepts based on this exact same design that do not use the microphone, but use other electronic components as well. But that creates a little bit more complexity in the fabrication process. So there's a cost and benefit analysis you have to do. All right, to summarize the whole talk, I've given you a lot of information, and we really have just scratched the surface of how we go from bio-inspiration to using a multidisciplinary approach, using experimental approaches from biology, physics, and engineering to the development of novel acoustic sensors. And so I'd be happy to take, first of all, I should say, I want to thank all of the funding agencies for supporting this research. And secondly, I'd like to thank everyone that worked on these projects. And I'd definitely like to make a special thank you to soon-to-be Dr. Andrew Reed and soon-to-be Dr. Yang-Chen Zhang, as this is all of their work from their PhD dissertations. And of course, thank all of you for your attention and not falling asleep. Thank you.